Welcome to Wining and Dining with Jim White, the podcast devoted to bringing you the stories about the people who make the eats and drinks you love. Hi, I'm Jim White. On today's show, a quick journey to Virginia wine country in Albemarle County for some destination wining and dining in the shadow of Thomas Jefferson's legacy. We'll stop by Monticello and meet the man who carried out Jefferson's vision of Virginia as a wine-producing region and introduce you to some of the top wineries in close proximity to charming Charlottesville.
It's definitely wine country. Virginia is one of the top five wine producers in the U.S., and a lot of the vineyards here are just stunning, stunning property and making good wines from all kinds of different grapes.
We start our Virginia sojourn with some elegant hospitality in beautiful Keswick Hall.
So we're here outside at the original entrance to the Villa Crawford that was built in 1912.
That's Paul Shockley, the hotel's guest services manager.
We're looking right into the Blue Ridge Mountains over the new Horizon Pool. It's an infinity pool with gorgeous views with a backdrop overlooking the golf course. Out toward the pool, you can see the fountain that's on the 18th green of, it's about 600-acre property currently. In 1912, when Mr. Crawford originally had purchased the area, it was only 134 acres, so it's almost tripled since that time frame. We also are looking down at to our members' clubhouse, which was built in the 90s, that now has a spa, a fitness center, a member restaurant, as well as the golf pro shop. Also in that direction, we have some of the hiking trails that you can get to on the property. There's three hiking trails that lead out from there that you can go down to either by bicycle or by foot as well. The area here is, it's beautiful. Basically where the pool was the original drive to the Villa Crawford. So when you pulled up, you would come in this entryway here and greet Mr. Crawford. And the house was his until about 1945, 1950, when they did sell it as and turn it into a country club instead of a private residence.
It's our first time to even try Virginia wines. So what better way to get an overview than from Keswick Hall's sommelier, Melissa Boardman.
Over 1,000 selections down here in the cellar with a big focus on Burgundy, Bordeaux, a good amount of German Rieslings, and then, of course, grand selection of Virginia wines and some nice deep selection of Cabernets from California. Of course, a lot of Pinot Noirs, both from California and Oregon.
What's your take on Virginia wine, just overall?
Well, yeah, so I really didn't know what the wine scene was going to be like here, and I was pleasantly surprised because I'm from New York originally. So I have to say that the overall quality of Virginia wines far surpasses New York. The amount of wine here is actually pretty amazing. There's over 460 wineries now in Virginia, which is pretty wild. And then, you know, the focus here, white wines, almost everyone does a Viognier, which is I was really shocked by. Cabernet Sauvignon does not do well here, just doesn't get quite warm enough. And Cabernet really likes gravelly soils. Mm-hmm. Soils here are more limestone and clay. So that's why you see more Petit Verdot, Merlot, and a lot of blends.
How do they compare?
So, I mean, I would say, you know, in on the New World scene, very good. Mm-hmm. There's a few great, such as Barbersville does a Bordeaux blend called Octagon, which is probably the most famous wine that comes from here. And when it's young, it's really grippy. It's very reminiscent of a big Napa Cab. But with age on it, I've had it back in the 90s, and it tastes like old Bordeaux. If I would have tasted it blind, I would have thought it was like, you know, a second growth. I mean, the quality was outstanding, so that's pretty spectacular. A few other highlights, Linden makes Chardonnays, single vineyard Chardonnays, and seriously to the level of really good California Chardonnay. So the Viogniers are fun. Like we were talking about earlier, they really range from bone dry, mineral driven, to on the more tropical, fruit driven side. And not too many are on the sweet side like they can get in California. They still maintain a lot of minerality. And again, I think that's because of the soils here. Just works really well with these limestone soils.
So 460 wineries all over the state, or is there a concentration area? I mean, a lot in the Charlottesville area.
Yeah. Where we are. So it is, they all are all over the state. We're in the Monticello AVA. Just to the west of us is the Shenandoah region. But all, I mean, it's crazy. I was just down in Outer Banks. And even out there, like by the ocean, they're growing. Yeah, it's everywhere.
Thomas Jefferson did love this area, and he loved the University of Virginia. He loved Charlottesville. And
loved wine, too.
He did. He did. He has quite a collection. When you tour Monticello, you can see how, in the 1700s, how he was keeping it in the barrels and all that. It's fascinating and intriguing to see how he was doing that way before anybody else was.
So, bright and early the next morning, my favorite wine tasting partner, my super taster wife, Vicki Briley White, and I head out to explore the hallowed grounds of Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. We have the immense honor of getting a personal tour from Gabriele Rossi, director of Garden and Grounds and the pioneer of the modern wine industry in Virginia.
I think you can produce irresistible wine in Virginia. The secret is the location where you grow the grapes, the soil on which you planted, and the quantity that you produce per acre. That is an interesting point because there are vineyards which are next to each other. The wine from one is much better than the wine from the quantity is very important, you know. It's very different for a mother to try to raise 15 children and have them all perfect, or raise two children and make them both perfect. It's the same thing, right?
While we consider Thomas Jefferson a founding father, certainly. He may well be the founding father of the American wine industry, too. Would you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's interesting to me. He planted vines 10 times. Right? This is what we have in the record. It's interesting that sometimes there were vines which were given to him, but eventually he took the decision in 1907 of doing experimental vineyard. And in the experimental vineyard, he planted 20 different kind of vines. And, you know, in 1983, I grafted these vines for Monticello. Eventually, the things start to fall apart because they don't last forever. And this spring I was going through the vineyard and I was checking every variety. You know, there are six of one kind, six of the other, and the thing. And I said, look, the Cabernet Sauvignon is still all intact. How wonderful to decide to plant all this variety in the same spot to be able to compare exactly what happened. Because if I plant an acre up there, an acre here, or different thing, I cannot really have a final, you know, result and the real statement of what situation is. But planting them there, say, look at the message that he gave us. Cabernet Sauvignon will do fine in Virginia on the south slope and on the proper, how do you say, well-drained area. So the variety he planted, half are French, half are Italian, two are American, right? But I was very inspired by certain selection he made. For example, Chasselas Doré. I don't know if you're familiar with the variety. It's grown in Switzerland to make a wine called Fandan. And actually, I plant 2 acres for myself this year because I really want to make the wine. It's a cluster which is very loose, right? The skin is also a little bit thick. So, of course, in a climate which is a bit crazy, like Virginia climate is, it makes sense to plant a plant like that, to experiment with a plant like that. Nobody ever tried to plant it, but Jefferson did, and now I did it myself 2 years ago, so I will have a little crop next year. But I really look at the way he decides to use a little bit of everything, to experiment with a little bit of everything, to see what was doing best. Now, another good story. When they asked me to graft the vines, one of the variety was Muscat of Alexandria. I don't know if you're familiar. Zibibbo in Sicily. And when they told me, I said, this will never grow in Virginia. But they said, well, you graft it, we plant it, and then if he die, we will write down that he's dead. I said, okay, good. So we planted 15 vines in 1984, the first one died in 2004. Isn't that wonderful? Do you understand what a unique location it is, Monticello, and the south slope? Come on, it's he knew what he was doing, right?
That's amazing.
That is great.
Yeah.
Wonderful
yeah.
story.
Yeah. It's beautiful, really, to see the fact that at a certain moment, I think he was 1803, he write to Madame de Tassé, the aunt of Lafayette, and he tell her, I'm looking forward to draw a curtain between me and the political world. I want to be a florist. I love it. It means I had enough of all these things. I want to do something that I like. So, I mean, I think he was a wonderful man, and he did what he did because he wanted to help his country, help his people, not because he really loved to do what he did. We will walk through the flower garden. We will see that there are labels on almost every flower. If there is a TJ, means that Jefferson mentioned the plant in his garden book. If there is an LNC, it means that Lewis and Clark sent the seed from the West when they went to take a look at what was going on over there. And if there is none of the two, it means that the flower was available in the state, the plant was available in the state, but Jefferson never mentioned it. And when people challenge me on the fact that Jefferson didn't mention this, didn't do that, I always answer only in one way. Jefferson didn't have the time. because you were too busy, right? There was no computer, no this thing. No.
Well, all this history and exploration has made us hungry. We head for lunch at the place weary travelers have stopped for centuries, the fascinating Mickey Tavern, for a comfort food reverie and conversation with Executive Director Greg McDonald.
The Mickeys actually came to the country in the mid-1700s, settled in the Charlottesville area. John Mickey, who was an indentured servant, and he was quite successful paying off his debts and acquiring 3,000 acres in the area. His son William is the one who actually started the tavern in 1784. And taverns, as most people know, 18th century taverns were the restaurants and the social centers for every, and also the hotels for every community. The Mickeys, because they're a prosperous family, ran a nicer tavern than most and ended up with a great reputation. And it ran in the Mickey family for about 100 years before it was finally replaced by restaurants and hotels.
Now, the setting today looks pretty accurate to a modern-day viewpoint. Right. Why don't you take us on a visual tour, if you will, which is something you can do through Theater of the Mind.
Sure. Mickey Tavern sits on Monticello Mountain, so we overlook the area. You're in the Piedmont section of Virginia, so lots of rolling hills within our view site. On our property, we have a variety of buildings that have been brought in from around the state over the last 45 years. We have a gristmill on the property, a few other 18th and 19th century structures that we use as historically accurate retail structures. And then the tavern is the focal point of the property. We offer tours through the oldest section, so you learn what tavern life was really like in the 18th century. And then we offer lunch in our dining room.
Let's talk about that lunch. It was pretty spectacular.
Yeah. So we try to make Mr. Mickey proud as he looks down on his tavern. And we'd like to think we're serving a meal very similar to what he would have been serving 200 years ago. It's all the southern delicacies. We've built our reputation on our fried chicken. That's what we're best known for. But as you just experienced, we have some great pulled pork barbecue. We have southern delicacies like black-eyed peas and stewed tomatoes and lots of good home-cooked southern foods, comfort food as we would call it, homemade mashed potatoes and green beans. And then we have some nice desserts, and we always encourage people to consider our peach cobbler a la mode, which is, I think, our best dessert.
And I can attest, it was quite delicious.
Great.
We were sitting in the area, I believe, called the courtyard.
Correct.
And a wonderful view. Tell people what they're going to be seeing out of the windows when they're here at Mickey's Tavern.
We're just south of Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. So we're looking out over Charlottesville. It's a very similar view that Jefferson had because we are on Monticello Mountain. And interestingly enough, most people know that Mr. Jefferson started the University of Virginia, and he could follow the construction of it by looking across town, which is, as the crow flies, about 5 miles away. So we can see all of Charlottesville and the University of Virginia in the distance, and then the Blue Ridge Mountains are the background for our view shed. Most folks are up on Monticello Mountain during the day, seeing Monticello and Monroe's home, Highland. So we are a nice complement to those two sites. You're always safe getting in the door between 11:30 and 3. We encourage people, because we serve a hearty meal, they can certainly make it the main meal of the day instead of waiting till dinner time.
Good advice, too.
Yes.
For folks who want to visit you online, how about the website?
It's very easy. It's mickeytavern.com, but Mickey is not spelled as you would expect it.
Like Walt Disney did.
Right. So it's mickeytavern.com.
And now for the piece de resistance of our journey to the Charlottesville area, let's do some wine tasting. Our first stop has to be Jefferson Vineyards. Here, winemaker Chris Ritzkuban gives us an overview and significance of the Virginia wine industry.
Jefferson Vineyards came about in 1981. The vineyards were first planted. A few years later, they opened up the winery. I think that was in 1986. And now we've grown to about 24 acres of vineyard. We grow Bordeaux reds, and with our whites, we grow Chardonnay, Viognier, Virginia signature white grape, along with Riesling, Petit Mansing, Pinot Gris. Our case production ranges from about, is in the 6,000 case range. We make about 10 different wines, and we are known most for our Viognier and our Meritage, and I think Virginia is a great place to grow Petit Verdot and Cabernet Franc as well. This is the property where he initially gave land to Filippo Mazze to plant grapes pre-Revolutionary War. That didn't work out entirely well. They were trying to grow vinifera. They didn't have the science. They didn't know the climate. And then after that, they were met with the Revolutionary War. So that sort of was put on the back burner in terms of trying to grow grapes. We named the property, the vineyard, after Jefferson. We try to strive to promote his style of wines and grow the reputation of Virginia as a quality grape growing and winemaking region. I think the beautiful thing about Virginia wine is that we're not cranking out the same product every year. Sometimes different varieties show better in years. We have lots of vintage variation. And for me, I find that to be somewhat nostalgic and sort of the fun, romantic part of Virginia winemaking. You have the really hot, really big wines from 2010. You have the much lighter style wines from 2011 when it rained for almost 6 weeks straight in the middle of harvest. It was a highly challenging vintage. And we just have so much variation. And in fact, that can affect the wines. But I think we strive to create a consistent product through blending and finding the varietals that do best in this climate.
Hospitality is a major part of the equation when visiting Virginia wineries. And they are equipped to handle just about anything you need, from individuals to large parties. Most have extensive tasting rooms and welcome you to stay, taste, and enjoy their beautiful surroundings. Let's head to Blenheim Vineyards, which adds a dash of rock and roll stardom to its blend. Winemaker Kirsty Harmon explains.
Yeah, so we're in a very lucky spot. In the past 15, 16 years that I've been making wine, when I started making wine in 2000, I think there were 50 to 60 wineries. And now, today, there are almost 300 in the state. So it's grown by leaps and bounds, which is pretty encouraging to see. And Virginia wine drinkers are incredibly loyal to drinking Virginia wine.
There's quite a musical connection here with Blenheim.
We're owned by Dave Matthews of the Dave Matthews Band. Mm-hmm. He purchased the property for his mother in 1999. The yellow house on the hill that you might have passed as you came in.
Yeah.
And she said, that's great. She said, but we have to do something with the land. She didn't want to just have a house on a hill and not do anything with the property. Mm-hmm. And so there was an old vineyard planted on the property, and it gave them the idea to replant. So the vineyard had been planted, I think, late 70s. It was in pretty good disarray by the time they got here in the 1990s, but it gave them the idea. And so Peter Matthews, Dave Matthews' brother, was the vineyard manager, and a friend of Dave's named Brad McCarthy was the first winemaker. And he was the winemaker until 2007, and I started in 2008.
Does Dave pop around?
Does
Dave
he does like every now and then. Yeah. I can't tell you when.
Yeah.
Because people will camp out.
Oh, no, I wouldn't ask.
But he does stop by from time to time. He's a busy guy. He has a pretty good day job that keeps him on the road.
Yeah.
But he does stop by and takes pictures and signs autographs with people a few times a year.
So does that day job keep him where you want him? So, I mean, in other words, he's not saying, you know, Kirsty, I think if you did this with the blends, it would be...
I'm in an incredibly lucky position. He does leave the winemaking up to me. So I leave the singing to him, and it seems to work out okay. No, it's a very lucky position to be in that I have complete freedom in the wines that I make. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I don't always know what I'm doing, but I wing it, and so far it's been okay.
You touched on this, but give people a sense, kind of set the stage for them, Virginia's position within the wine world. Where do you guys fare?
Big underdog, and we have been an underdog since the get-go, and we still have a lot more work to do. I think Virginia wines are now just becoming more interesting for people outside of the state. I think for a long time, not very many people outside of Virginia knew that Virginians were making wine. But now with the influx of really talented winemakers coming into the area and also owners that are consistently interested in producing the best quality Virginia wine they can, and they have the finances to back that up, mm-hmm. I think we're moving at a much faster pace now than we were 10 years ago.
So what is making the Virginia wine so interesting? Let's talk about some of those flavors and styles.
I think we have a very challenging environment for growing grapes. I think there's not one winemaker in Virginia that would tell you otherwise. But it is challenging to come up with the right varieties in the right spots to make wines that we're proud of. And I think the joy of making wine here is that it's always an experiment. There's always something new to experiment with, a new variety. I've done whole cluster inclusion experiments and all sorts of crazy things, crazy winemaking things to try and really get the best of what we can out of the grapes.
We're tasting a little bit of the wine. There you go, folks. What you're supposed to do when you're tasting wine, you don't swallow it all.
So the goal with all of my wines is to make them approachable and drinkable now. I'm not a very patient person, so I enjoy wines in their youth. I think it's a smart move for Virginia. I think it makes more sense to make a wine that's a little bit more approachable, a little bit less oak aged, but that's my preference.
Are all of your grapes sourced from your vineyards?
Always from Virginia, not always from our vineyards. We've increased production from 10 acres, we'll have 34 acres next year. So we have increased pretty dramatically in the last 3 years. So by 2020, or somewhere around there, we'll be all estate grown. But for now, I'm using a lot of really great growers across the state. It gets me out of the winery a little bit and exploring the rest of Virginia. And Virginia has so many different climates and soils, it's nice to see grapes from other areas.
I really like that Chardonnay because it's so lively.
Thank you.
And it doesn't have that heaviness and that oak, basically that oak aftertaste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to use oak.
Friendlier wine with food.
Right. And that, I'm always thinking about food because I learned how to make wine from an Italian. You never think about wine without food, or it's rare. And so I'm always thinking of trying to push the acidity a little bit more, have a bit more acidity so that it balances with food a little bit better. So what you're tasting now is the 2015 Viognier. Totally different story than the Chardonnay because the grape is so much more floral and tropical than the kind of apple and pear that you might have gotten off of the Chardonnay. It's a really nice grape. It grows really well in Virginia, even if the vineyards growing the grapes themselves slightly challenging. Some years you have a decent sized crop, some years the crop is fairly small. So we're working in the vineyard to try and understand that better. So next up are a set of Cabernets. So we've got Cabernet Franc and Cabernet Sauvignon. Most people will say that Cabernet Sauvignon does not grow well here, and it depends on the site, it depends on the place, and it depends on the vintage. So I don't make a Cabernet Sauvignon every year, but I do make a Cabernet Franc every year because I think Cabernet Franc is one of the grapes that's the most consistent from year to year. It's 100% aged in barrels. I use a combination of French, American, and Hungarian. It was only in barrels for 9 months. So nothing that I make stays in barrels longer than 10 months, 11 months. And usually that's something like Petit Verdot, which I feel can handle a little bit more oak. Mm-hmm. But again, the wines are to drink now. All the wines are bottled with screw caps. If I were aging wines, I would still use screw caps. But this is all kind of hopefully going towards the idea that wine can be approachable. It doesn't have to be so stressful when you're trying to, you know, how to pair the wine, what to do. It can be, and I think it should be, an everyday beverage that helps improve your mood, your life, and your meal, right? Your meal. So yeah.
Oh, hard interview assembly.
Yeah, I know. Wait, we either need to get closer to the drain or bring, or just start drinking it.
You know? Either way.
Talk about your relationship with your mentor, Gabriele.
Yeah, well, I would not be making wine if it weren't for Gabriele. I met Gabriele in 2000. I had just started working for Kluge Estate. I was sort of in charge of running a retail operation that hadn't started yet. And so it was taking a little bit longer to get that off the ground. And so Patricia Kluge said, well, build a winery, dear. Mm-hmm. And so I met Gabriele the next day. We started to look at winery equipment, and I took a drive to Culpeper with him to look at winery equipment in his truck. And on that trip, he said, well, you have a science background. My original, I guess, career was microbiology. And so he said, well, if you have a science background, he said, you can be the winemaker. You can make wine. And I thought he was completely crazy. But I was told the next day that I was the winemaker with no experience at all. And so I got into winemaking by accident, completely by chance, but I fell in love with it. And so after working for Kluge Estate for a few years and Gabriele for a few years, he said, okay, so this is Virginia. And he said, you're a woman. He said, nobody's going to take you seriously until you go get a degree. So I moved to California and got a master's degree at UC Davis. Then spent a harvest in France and a harvest in New Zealand before I was hired at Blenheim. So I went around the whole world to come right next door to where I started, which is pretty cool.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty cool. Okay, I've been extremely fortunate and very lucky to have the path that I have been on so far.
As we travel the rural roads of Virginia wine country in Albemarle County, thank goodness for GPS, we round a bend and, just like a movie's reveal shot, an elegant rolling landscape of mountains, pines, and vineyards frames the stately main building of the Trump Winery. Yeah, that Trump. Winemaker Jonathan Wheeler finds a corner for us in the bustling tasting room to enjoy a Trump sparkling wine.
Ah, yes. A little pour.
This is a little Blanc de Blanc, 100% Chardonnay. This is Method Champenois. We do 4 sparkling wines at Trump Winery. One of the largest programs is our Blanc de Blanc. It's nice and creamy, aged 4 years on the yeast, and it's just classic Method Champenois.
Your 10th vintage here, I believe you were telling us?
Yeah, this is my 10th vintage in Virginia for this estate, actually. I came in 2006, and I've been making wine here ever since. It's been a great experience, and we're really doing some great things in our wine program, and we do some things that set us apart from some other wineries. So we do four programs here: Blanc de Blanc, 100% Chardonnay; Blanc de Noir, 100% Pinot Noir. We do a sparkling rosé, which is a blend of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir to make a nice, bright, vibrant sparkling rosé. And we do a sparkling reserve, which ages a little bit longer on the yeast. So we do all, like as I said, we do all method champenois sparkling wines. This is our 2010 Blanc de Noir. Blanc de Noir meaning white from black. This is 100% Pinot Noir. We harvest the Pinot Noir early, usually in the very beginning of August, to get kind of the nice, rich acidity that the Pinot has without extracting too much from the skins from the red grape. So we harvest this very early. We typically harvest in the middle of the night, so we get lights out. We walk through the vineyard. We handpick everything. We bring it into the winery cool. We take it and put it into the press and gently press it. Really important that we only extract just the best juice. So we're only using the Cour de Cuvée, which is the heart of the juice. No hard press, no beginning press. So the first juice that comes off the press and the last juice comes off the press, we don't use for the sparkling wine because it lacks acidity, and it's also getting some extraction from the skins. So this one's just a nice classic aging. So this aged 3 years on the yeast, and it's just nice, creamy. But I also age it in a little bit of neutral French oak barrels. So it's about 1/3 neutral French oak, which brings another element to the wine, which is kind of fun.
Some rowdy voters back here. Well, what about good restaurants to go along with all this fine wine? Charlottesville is home to a growing culinary scene with a robust farm-to-table sensibility and some outstanding chefs. We stopped by Heirloom Restaurant in the Graduate Charlottesville Hotel for some great downtown action near the campus of UVA and dramatic rooftop dining on Chef Alan Flint's menu.
We are doing a lot of things with our local purveyors, and we're going on and off and based on what they have available. And right now, turkey, because it's come to the holidays, and the sweet potato biscuits. So we put those on the Heirloom menu, trying to bring back some of the comfort foods for the fall. And that's why we have the vegetarian chili, and we have a vegetarian tomato soup. And it's all about trying to incorporate things for our area. We're doing things with the tomatoes from a local farmer that's right here on the mountain side. And then the biscuits, we're using a local purveyor with their flour. And then some of our other items, we've used a brook trout that comes right from North Carolina, just across. We pull a lot of our produce out of Pennsylvania. And we're still working with a lot of the cheese farmers around the area that do a lot of goat cheese and some cow cheese also. So we're drawing a lot on that. It looks like people would like to have two or three different tastings of items. We've got our Virginia peanuts, and of course peanuts are, if you don't know, the Planter's Peanut was right down the road here in Surrey, Virginia, which is about an hour and a half away. And there you go. And the peanuts, we are famous for our peanuts. I mean, you can get all sorts of varieties. And then we've put on these Chesapeake crab cakes, which we use lump crab that comes from the Chesapeake. And then it's very low mixture on any breading at all. Being that I'm in the Williamsburg area and closer to the shore, if you put something out that has any breadcrumbs in it, you just like, you know, you're disgraceful. So we really try to make sure that we're doing things that are right and right for the area. When we started out our menu, we had it completely with Virginia wines and a lot of Virginia liquors also, Virginia whiskeys and some of the bourbons, some of the whiskeys, some of the ryes. We have some vodka also from here. So there's a bunch of different things that we've been doing, and all our beers that are on tap are local beers. And a big one here is the apple cider. And Bold Rock apple cider, which is one of the ones that we're doing right now. And then we're getting ready to also incorporate a couple of the other cider producers around here. The apples for the apple cider beer come from Crown Orchards, and it's good, very good.
For a walk on the fun side, visit Charlottesville Downtown Mall, and be sure to visit Commonwealth Restaurant and Sky Bar. Meet Chef Reggie Calhoun.
It's a very cool restaurant.
How do you describe your cuisine?
It doesn't really have like a certain lane that it's in, which I think is more interesting for me. I mean, you know, this is my kitchen. It's Kirk Kitchen, but, you know, the guys that I work with as well help out a lot as well. Something that I've always liked to do is just like kind of just try everything. I really wouldn't say it was the one cuisine. I could tell you my favorite, though, which is definitely Caribbean, because pretty much everyone in my family is from either Trinidad or Grenada or Jamaica or something.
Yeah.
But the scene around here is We have a lot of restaurants, so this town's definitely a foodie town.
So much good food and wine, so little time. Other favorites during our visit include the dazzling Pippin Hill Vineyards, which also features one of the tastiest restaurants you'll ever visit right inside the winery, and King Family Vineyards. In all, there are 20 vineyards along the Monticello Wine Trail. During our brief wining and dining excursion to Virginia, we didn't even have time to get to the myriad craft beer producers in Albemarle County. And if you like cider, be sure to visit Albemarle Cider Works for a heavenly taste treat from delicious Virginia apples. No doubt about it, for history, culture, and gourmet delights galore, just go to the website, visitcharlottesville.org, and start planning your visit to this wonderful part of Virginia in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Thanks for joining us today on Wining and Dining with Jim White, the podcast devoted to introducing you to the men and women who create the flavors you love. You can catch all of our episodes on Vocal Media and on iTunes. And for more news you can use about Wining and Dining, visit our website, wineanddinedfw.com. Until next time, I'm Jim White, reminding you that if anybody asks you what you're making for dinner, tell them reservations.